Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, that's great. That sounds terrific. Thank you.
Murder. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. For the past couple of weeks, we've been discussing deadly shootings that have been justified by either the Castle Doctrine or the Make My Day Law, simply because of two components. It was either a homeowner or a business owner was involved in the shooting, and the shooter, either he or she perceived that they were being threatened. And that alone has allowed the authorities to say that obviously the shootings were justified. But were they? or was it really murder? Tonight, my guest will help me sort all this out. But before we begin, let me remind you that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage or the host. My guest tonight, a smart group of people tonight, y'all, and I'm very excited to have them with us tonight. We have attorney Anthony McKesson. He's a criminal attorney in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Also, we have Dr. Zoe Spencer. She's a sociology professor. And with us is attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds. Good evening, everyone, and welcome again to Center Stage. Let me open up your phone line.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I sent each of you all an email today. I hope everyone received it, about a shooting in Erie, Colorado. Did everybody get it?
Yes.
Well, I did not, but let me open up my email now.
Okay. There was a situation in Erie, Colorado that totally speaks to what we're talking about tonight. And if you read it, if you haven't, we'll try to give you an overview, Anthony. But basically it appears that a lady by the name of Elaine Cordova says that, last Saturday night, I guess it was, she was asleep and she woke to find two men in her house. And she supposedly, in this house where she lives, grows medical marijuana. I don't know if that's connected to the story or not. But anyway, some kind of way, she ends up critically wounding one and killing the other. But what happened was she didn't call the police. So this happens on Saturday night, and so the man, one of them that was critically injured, managed to make it home, and his roommates took him to the emergency room. Well, Monday morning, the police show up at her door, and they tell her as they drove up, they found the body of one of these people that she stabbed. Well, he wasn't dead from a stab wound. He was dead from a gunshot wound, which totally conflicts with her story. But they're trying to justify the shooting under the Castle Doctrine, the Make My Day law. And so even though she didn't call the police and she grows marijuana in her house, somehow this woman is still possibly going to get off on the fact that they were in her house and she perceived them to be a threat. Dr. Zoe and attorney Bobby Edmonds, y'all read the article that I sent. What do you all think, or what do you make of her story versus what appears to have happened? Either of you.
Well, I can say, just reading what you sent, I can say that, and I don't know, because I haven't had the opportunity to compare the Make My Day law with the Castle Doctrine, but I know the Castle Doctrine, as it is codified in South Carolina, has a specific clause in it that says that a person cannot be exonerated, or the homicide cannot be justifiable if there's something illegal, or if the homeowner or business owner is engaged in something illegal in his or her home at the time of the homicide. So medical marijuana, I'm not sure what the laws are where this occurred and what kind of permit you have to grow, quote-unquote, medical marijuana, whether it was legal or not. But I can say that if it is not a government-sanctioned or if it is not legal, and she doesn't have the right to do that, then under South Carolina statute, that would exempt her from being protected under the Castle Doctrine.
Attorney Edmonds, a shooting and not call the police, and then the police show up at your door 3 days later or 2 days later, and it's okay?
It would be suspect, of course. Of course, I would definitely have to look at the facts surrounding the circumstances, mm-hmm. and, of course, the newspapers don't report everything,
mm-hmm.
but I would have to be cautious on her motive for not calling the police. But generally, you would call the police unless you have something to hide yourself.
Okay.
So that's going to be something that's looked at. Additionally, the doctrine in Texas provides protection, but it doesn't provide protection for a person who is also engaging in illegal conduct.
Exactly.
So she may not be able to get the protection here, but I'm not sure whether or not the medical marijuana could have been grown in her house. What are the quantities? Whether or not it was a small amount for her personal use, But generally, if it's medical marijuana, you purchase it.
Get it. Exactly.
You have your prescription, and it is you can back it up with a doctor's prescription. So if you take it upon yourself because you need the medical need marijuana, and then proceed to just grow it to abate having to buy it, then you're engaging in an illegal activity. And it appears that some of the factual circumstances may be that these individuals knew that.
Exactly.
So never know. It's too early, really, to determine the outcome. But as things develop, then we could proceed and have different interpretations.
Attorney McKesson, it appears that originally she was arrested, but then they released her on bond, and I think originally it looks like they were trying to charge her with second-degree murder. But now, if I'm looking at this second update correctly, it looks like they're saying that, you know, she may not face charges, but they did not close the investigation, which seems like in Erie, Colorado, they're at least being cautious before they clear her. Would you say so?
Well, I would agree as far as that it's really, you know, too early and not enough information to say if it's a matter of them being cautious or a matter of them just simply displaying an attitude of indifference. I mean, I certainly agree with the previous panelist that it certainly seems odd that if someone was engaged in something that that they're legally allowed to do, because I would presume if when we say medical marijuana, I presume they have some type of documentation that would allow them to do that, although I would presume it would be in a lab. But nonetheless, if they were authorized to do what they're doing, I truly can't understand why someone wouldn't call the police unless they have concerns about getting themselves in trouble with something else. So, you know, right now I would just say it's too early to say if the police are being cautious or just, you know, or just uncaring.
But where in America do you stab two people and don't think to call 911?
And also, Carrie, one of the things that concern me about the case, too, as well as all of the cases that I have heard and have been working on, is that she said that she stabbed them initially. However, both of them are either dead from or in critical care from a gunshot wound. And what it doesn't say in the report, it does say that she stated that she stabbed them, but the one actually died from a gunshot wound, and it does not say whether or not there were stab wounds found in addition to the gunshot wound. So that's another question that needs to be asked, because certainly you know whether or not you stabbed or shot someone.
Well, the other question could be that we don't know her state of mind and whether or not she was actually sane enough, or was she high and really don't remember.
Because, you know, the thing is, the police said that when they found the body at the edge of the property, didn't she say something like, oh, my God, I didn't know I did that or something? It was something like that in the report that she said, I'm looking for it. It said something like, oh, my God, I didn't know that I – she said, oh, my God, I didn't know that I killed him. They were coming at me. See, again, that whole term about the perceived threat scares me. I think the law needs to be closed in a little bit more to define what's a real threat versus a perceived threat, because I think that whole perceived threat leaves too broad of a window. I mean, someone look at you.
Well,
go ahead.
In Texas, you could be protecting your property or someone else's property. They had a case where a gentleman was watching his neighbor's property, and there were two African-Americans, and this was a white gentleman, and they were retreating. So he shot them in the back, and he got off because he was protecting the neighbor's property who had left him in control. It was a lot of controversy, but it was extended to him, giving him protection, and he wasn't even charged.
I have a question. May I ask a question? In Texas, does it state in your version of the Castle Doctrine, does it state property, protecting property, or because I know in South Carolina.
Yeah, look, let me tell you, it has habitation, vehicle, place of business or employment.
But does it say that you're allowed to protect that property, or does it say that if a person invades that property with the purpose of causing a threat to your life or your well-being, or can you use deadly force in order to simply protect your property?
In Texas, you can use the force that's reasonably necessary to protect your property, your family, and your property, and if someone else leaves you in custody or care of their property, to protect.
That's very scary.
That is scary.
It is scary. Well, it was a very, very, unkindly case here, and people were very upset, particularly the African-Americans,
exactly.
That these two guys were shot retreating, and it wasn't even the gentleman's property. It was a neighbor's property that he was allowed to protect.
But see, you know
and
what?
If I can
go ahead, Miguel.
If I can add in, and this is something hopefully that we can discuss in more detail, but you know, for these proponents of expanding the Make My Day law and the Castle Doctrine, these cases, I think, are just the tips of the iceberg in terms of I don't think anyone has really considered who they're opening an invitation for the use of deadly force.
True.
You know, the people that support it typically talk about, you know, a homeowner or someone connected with a business. But in looking at various expansions of this law throughout the country, the way that most of these are written, it could be, in essence, a third party or a neighbor who says they perceive a threat to someone else, and they're using force, and all they have to really say is that they perceived a danger and that deadly force is needed. And we really, in my opinion, we really just start opening up for people just to assess situations on their own without any consequence or liability.
Mm. But, you know,
in Texas, they just use a lot of words like reasonably believe that the force is immediately necessary to protect. And so it's going to be what you think is reasonable at the time of the, quote, emergency.
And I think that the whole concept of perception of a threat, you know, and no one wants to talk about race, and I know that I brought it up and on the last conversation, but I think that we have to definitely discuss the implications to the African-American community because, you know, while I do know because of the cases I'm working on that some others will get caught in the larger net, I do understand that, you know, sociologically there is it's more easy to accept the perception of fear of an African-American male than it would be of a Caucasian woman. And so, you know, one of the things that I've noticed that have gone across the board with the cases that I've been working on and that I've been listening to and researching is that people state, I thought they had a gun or they had a gun or I perceived the threat. And when it comes to people's application of just was justifiable or not, it seems like it's easy to exonerate the homeowner or the business owner when the person is either African American or when the person has some kind of sketchy past that can be subject in society. So I think we have to invoke that into the discussion.
And I agree.
Well, I think that plays a role in how justice is administered throughout America.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's supposed to be justice within the court sometimes. It's not. So race does matter, and we just have to face it. Even though we want to say race does not matter, it does. It matters in terms of racial profiling.
Right.
And in these instances, stereotyping.
True.
But are we going to say that everybody that steals something from us, we ought to just kill them? I mean, because that's really what it seems like it's coming down to. We're not even clearly defining what happened in these cases other than to say somebody perceived a threat because in certain situations, nothing was even taken. You know, somebody was just on the property or someone, you know, just in all these different scenarios, it really doesn't clearly play out what happened that made you feel like you had to shoot and kill him. I can see shoot to wound him, but I don't understand all these situations they shot to kill people. And nobody's shooting to harm, everybody's shooting to kill. And so is the law just saying kill him, or is the law saying, you know, no, I mean, first of all, we're just going to take calling the police out of the equation anymore altogether? We're not going to even bother to call the police? We're just going to shoot to kill everybody that steals something from us? That's going to be
not
a bad world to live in.
Or not. Not even that they're stealing from you, because, you know, in the case of Mark Howard, I question whether or not he was, well, I know for a fact, based on West Columbia's own evidence, that he was not stealing anything. He had not stolen anything from the homeowner. So, you know, I think even with the stealing, I think we have to even reduce that to if someone is on your property, you know, or if someone is beside your car, does that give you the right to use deadly force to, quote-unquote, protect your property? And I'm still stuck because it's really scary, and I believe that as we challenge these cases, just like the Oklahoma case, as we challenge these cases, then what the legislators go and do is they just revamp and amend the existing doctrine or the existing code to cover the homeowners and protect the homeowners. And what this looks like to me from, you know, a sociological or socio-historic perspective is that we have really returned to vigilantism, and we've definitely returned to what I call neo-lynching.
Okay.
Well,
and
the other thing.
If I can, go ahead.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, just to add to Carrie's question about if law is sanctioning, and I'm just going to just call it flat out, the law is sanctioning murder. For those who weren't on the air Wednesday, we had an Oklahoma state senator actually went so far as to say that, in his view, a person who is operating under the Make My Law doctrine can use as much force as possible. And the Oklahoma case, we had a pharmacist who shot an individual, went outside to pursue his co-criminal. Appears that he emptied his gun, came back into the pharmacy, got his second gun loaded, and then pumped 5 bullets into the first kid who had injured in the head with a gunshot. And our state senator went so far as to say that if it was him, he would have loaded even a third gun. And he even went so far as to say that if the defendant in the Oklahoma case had went so far as to shoot, stab, and beat the victimless kid at this point, or the defenseless kid at this point, our senator said that all would have been perfectly reasonable and logical to him. So, unfortunately, I think that, you know, what that politician said may very well be reflective of a lot of attitudes of that, yeah, we're just going to sanction murder as long as the person knows enough to say, I reasonably perceive the fear, whether it actually existed or not.
And you know what else? They're probably getting the message to say, stay off your property if you're not authorized. Don't enter if you're not authorized. Don't try to enter vehicle, business, or you enter at your own risk and you may be killed.
And
they might as well put a sign out there, beware, you may be killed if you enter in an unauthorized or unauthorized reason.
So just trespassing can get you killed.
Go ahead.
And definitely if you try to get in home, all they're saying, come up there to that door, that person, or in the yard, if they think you're stealing, or trying to commit a robbery. So, and they can shoot you.
The slogan in South Carolina, and there are several, but Carrie pointed out last week that a former South Carolina Attorney General declared, quote-unquote, open season on home invaders. And so this slogan of open season on home invaders is really prevalent. But his quote was, invade a home, invite a bullet. That was his slogan. So
yeah.
it definitely is something that has been put into play.
I think so. You know, when I first heard this, and she's speaking of former Attorney General Charlie Condon said that, and, you know, he said things like the message needs to be sent loudly and clearly that the state is going to back the homeowner if the home is invaded. And so he's saying whatever happens, we're going to back the homeowner. So that's what seems to be happening across the board. All they have to say is they were on my property, I perceived the threat, and I killed them, and that's it. Nobody's asking any more questions past that. So is there something going on, in a rumbling undercurrent that we're not knowing about that's saying the police department is not going to mess with you, period? So just say certain words, and that's all you have to do, and you're taken care of? Because it seems to be working for a certain group. Let's just say that. And I'm not racist, y'all, but I'm just being honest. In all of these cases, you know, a white person did this, and I'm just wondering, or did the shooting. And I'm just wondering if these cases were different and a black person were killing white people because they trespassed on their property, would the stakes be the same?
And it's probably not, but do we have some cases where blacks have killed whites who are trying to get in their properties? Maybe that's something we need to look at to see what the ratio.
I mean, because in all of these scenarios, the person was white that did the shooting.
I know.
Yeah.
That's right.
And so, we just, you know, and I'm not in any, you know, first thing somebody says that she's just doing the race card. No, it's just really what it is. And so I'm just questioning, you know, if we look at this thing a little bit closer, if rich white kids were trespassing on black people's properties in the middle of the night, and a black person said, I perceived them to be a threat, so I shot, therefore I shot them, and then white people, you know, would they be alarmed then to say, well, why did you have to shoot him? You know, or would they say, okay, it was justified because the white kid didn't have any business there?
Well,
you know, I don't know.
They probably would be a little more cautious, put some more strict language in and defining, I guess, the perception of making it a little clearer with the surrounding circumstances. But
I agree
each case will have to rest upon its facts and the circumstances surrounding it. And so you see what
y'all,
the
y'all, we're going to take a call. We're going to go to area code 304-675. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Hey, how you doing?
How you doing?
Hello.
Oh, pretty good, girl. Yes. Hey, I just want to say, I live in West Virginia right now.
Okay.
And I'm not sure, I don't think West Virginia's got the castle law.
Really?
But if I walked out my door and I fired a shot in the air, I'd go to jail for discharging a firearm,
mm-hmm.
nothing else.
Ooh.
I was born and raised in Ohio. I'm a Buckeye. And Ohio got that law. And if you walk out your door in Ohio and you discharge a shell in the ground or in the air or whatever, you're going to go to jail for discharging a firearm.
Really?
But you can shoot a man, murdering,
mm-hmm.
in the neighbor's yard,
mm-hmm.
and it's justified.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That ain't got nothing to do with no justify. It ain't got nothing to do with no castle law.
Mm-hmm.
That's murder.
Hmm.
And
they're
getting away with
point.
It in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to add to that as well, because with the case of Mark Howard, not only did the homeowner and what the caller is stating, you know, if you discharge a firearm, and I'm not even sure, I probably need to look that up as well to see if there are any laws that cover that in South Carolina, because not only did the homeowner shoot three times, not only did he murder Mark Howard, but then he fired two other shots that landed in neighbors' homes. And one of the shots specifically, which is really concerning to me, because I'm pretty sure that they have reckless endangerment laws, one of the shots went through one of the neighbors' homes, through the siding, through the living room wall, through an exercise ball, entered and exited an exercise ball sitting in their living room, and went through the entertainment center and landed on the inside of the entertainment center. And when I saw the pictures of the exercise ball, you know, I'm like, okay, well, you know, it's one thing that you murdered Mark Howard because it was murder, but then there's another thing when, you know, at least, you know, you shot, I mean, you were obviously shooting on a run or something and you shot through the neighbor's home. What happens if there was a little child sitting in the living room? What happens if the child was sitting where the exercise ball was sitting? You know, then, you know, what would that be? So I think the caller brings up a really, really good point, you know, about even discharging firearms and how people are not considering their neighbors even when they're pursuing someone.
Well, in any place else, that would be murder, and they're calling it justified.
And if I can,
well,
if I can,
it's gonna,
if I can,
in Texas, that would probably be justifiable homicide. But with regards to the discharging of a firearm in the air, we have that in Texas, but that's going to be a misdemeanor. That's going to be the lesser offense. So most of the time, they don't even consider that if it is in the process of protecting your property.
And if I can add to that,
it looks at all the circumstances. And we're shooting
to
the neighbor. With shooting through the neighbor's home, they could charge that person with reckless endangerment or some other criminal act, because that's a separate and independent act of him shooting in that person's home, although it was at the time when he was allegedly protecting himself to shoot the other person. But even if you're doing that, you still should use caution and consider the other person's property, your neighbor's
property. Well, ma'am, let me ask you a question. If you're riding your bicycle down the driveway and a man coming behind you shooting, and then he kills you at the end of, well, in the road, on the other side of the road in the neighbor's yard.
Yeah.
Is that justified?
Well, let's tell you what. Dr. Zoe is working on that case. Dr. Zoe, can you set up exactly what happened with Mark Howard so that the listening audience can understand what the caller is speaking about?
Absolutely. But before I set up what happened with Mark Howard, I still, again, have to precurse that in South Carolina, there is not a property clause in South Carolina. South Carolina code specifically states that the use of deadly force is only warranted in the case where an individual poses a threat, an imminent threat. That means right now, and it can't be a projection later or perceived threat later, but an imminent threat. At that point, at the point of using deadly force, that the perpetrator has to be a threat to the individual's life or pose a threat to his general well-being. So he has to protect himself against what they call great bodily injury. That's basically it. And the person has to use forceful and forcible entry into the home or into an occupied vehicle, not an unoccupied vehicle or place of business. So the Castle Doctrine as it stands, I mean, even the doctrine itself by which other states codify, is basically not designed to protect property. It's just designed to allow people, if it's between you and I and you're using force and you have a weapon and I have to kill you to protect myself and my family, protect my life, or make sure that you don't cause great bodily injury to me, then I can do that. Mark Howard was outside on this person's yard, Mr. Williams' yard, by a truck. Mr. Williams saw him outside by the truck, and instead of staying in his home and calling the police, he grabbed his .38, ran outside to confront Mr. Howard. He states that he was raising the garage door, and Mr. Howard was already in the process of retreating from Mr. Williams' property. He had not touched his truck. There were no fingerprints on his truck. There was no forceful entry into his home or his truck. And as he was passing by, Mr. Williams shot at him twice. Now, the contradiction is that he states that he hit him when he was passing the garage and that he had shot him in the chest, and most people think that it's in the forward chest, but it wasn't. But somehow, two shots end up in the neighbor's yard, and then a third shot, I believe, takes Mr. Howard out on the neighbor's property. So whomever, whether it was Mr. Williams or someone else in the house, shot Mr. Howard when he was off of his property by the neighbor's yard. So that is the case, and I believe this is Mr. Howard's brother.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, welcome, welcome, welcome. but, you know, somehow this happens, and according to South Carolina law, that situation is clearly outside of the realms of the Castle Doctrine, and it's outside of the realms of self-defense common law. However, unlike the Oklahoma case that I am very, very envious of, Mr. Williams was neither arrested, nor was he charged, nor was the case prosecuted. And in spite of the fact that, you know, I had pointed out the contradictions, they still refused to reopen the case and to arrest and charge Mr. Williams.
Police cover up small.
And in that particular case, y'all, they have.
I don't believe it was a threat to the homeowner at that point if he was already off his property.
No, there was no threat.
At any point, because he could have stayed in his house.
And I think that case should be appealed on up to the Supreme Court of that state.
But
no,
you know
I love
what the
you
problem?
Too, girl.
Let
me
no charges. How are you gonna appeal if there's no charges?
That's the point. And let me throw this out to the panel because I'm looking for help and guidance because what I've done with this case is and the other that I'm working on is I've taken it out of South Carolina and I have sent a complaint and a request for an investigation into West Columbia Police Department and the state of South Carolina, including their attorney general and their solicitor's offices. You know, because of the misapplication of the Castle Doctrine. And I know that it takes time, but I've yet to get a response. And this is what I'm going to throw out because we're talking about the Castle Doctrine. And I'm listening to the panels, and it's interesting because Oklahoma and Texas, what do you all think about the possibility that there is a national mandate that is allowing states to implement these laws and these codes and then stand by these laws and codes even when the cases don't fit?
Yeah.
Well, I think this is what I think. I think that under the circumstances, and particularly in your circumstances, that you need to get the federal involved to come in.
They won't do nothing, ma'am.
I'm still waiting. We're still in waiting. And they told me I've called to the Attorney General's office, Eric Holder's office, and I'm putting it on notice. I've called. I've sent the complaint in. It's been more than about 2 or 3 weeks now for this case. It's been greater than about a month and a half for the other case that I'm working on. And there's still no response. And I've told them.
You sent to the FBI, too?
I surely did, both in South Carolina and the FBI Civil Rights Complaints Division in Washington, D.C. And I've sent the evidence, the documentation, and I've heard nothing. So, you know, listen, I'm putting it on notice that I'm concerned that, you know, and even looking at the Oklahoma case, Mr. McKesson, and he was trying to say something earlier, too, so I'm going to stop and let him speak.
Mr. McKesson, I did hear you trying to say something earlier.
Yes, what I was just trying to follow up on what the caller saying about the discharging of a weapon, he makes an excellent point in that, and I think what the audience needs to understand is the difference between the reckless discharging a firearm and the Castle Doctrine. The difference is exactly what the caller said, is if I walked out of my house and just shot off a round, and that round wounded or killed someone, I don't think there's a single person that would have a problem with me being charged with assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. I don't think anyone would have a problem with that injured person or their family suing me in civil court and collecting money. But the difference when you add the Castle Doctrine in, the way that people are, that the politicians are expanding it, is the Castle Doctrine is saying not only are you going to be immune from criminal liability, but civil liability. So now if we take the same scenario, but if I say now I perceived a threat from the person and I squeezed off around, and let's say I even missed my intended target and hit an innocent bystander, under the expanded Castle Doctrine, not only am I not responsible in the criminal system, criminal justice system, but the innocent bystander has no recourse in a civil lawsuit. So to me, it goes back to we've taken complete accountability out of the equation.
Is that being under a threat, though?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't you have to be threatened? And
well,
say somebody threatened you and missed you and hit the neighbor.
Well, who's liable
for that bullet that killed the neighbor's grandma?
What I'm saying to you is that's the way the law should work. The way that the supporters are trying to legislate it, they're trying to put the when they say reasonable fear, they're trying to put it solely upon the person using the deadly force. And what I just need people to be aware of is when we go down that path, we're simply saying that a person can use that deadly force without any accountability. Whereas in other areas of law, if I just simply shot off a gun without claiming fear, people would say that my act is not reasonable no matter what excuse I give.
Well, let me
jump in and ask a question since you brought up suing the homeowner. This particular family says this homeowner immediately took this property out of his name the day after this shooting. So if they decided that they wanted to pursue legal action in a wrongful death suit, can they, if he's already removed his property out of his name?
Well, they can always sue. The problem is going to be is what can they collect if he's depleted his assets.
Additionally, the homeowner's homestead is protected, but, of course, you must be sued to try to get to the insurance. And then if he is immune from civil liability, then he will not be liable. But just because he changes his name or property, if he could be liable, they could follow the property. Because if you transfer property, knowing or anticipating litigation or lawsuit or judgment within a certain time frame, they will say that that property still remained yours and you got rid of it to defraud the creditor.
And it
brings up a lot of different issues.
And he transferred it. I mean, I'm not worried about that because he transferred the property to his wife. It wasn't even that he really transferred it, you know, far enough. So, but my issue, you know, and this is what, you know, I've spoken to the Lewises about is not so much dealing with the homeowner. In this case, he definitely needs to be arrested. He definitely needs to be charged.
He needs to be charged.
And the case needs to be prosecuted. There's no doubt in my mind that he committed murder and that no matter what common law or what code or statute, unless they've made another one, and I don't know it because I've reviewed it backwards and forwards, it meets neither. But so my thing is that I'm not only going after the homeowner, I'm also going after the West Columbia Police Department and the solicitor's office and the assistant state's attorneys or the attorney general's office in South Carolina. Because what happens or what's happened in South Carolina with all of the cases is that officials become complicit in manipulating, fabricating, falsifying evidence, falsifying reports in order to create the justification for the justifiable homicide instead of allowing the evidence to speak for itself. And if you look at the evidence and you allow the evidence to objectively speak for itself, it's very clear that neither of the cases should be, people still shouldn't be walking free.
Let me ask a question on that, speaking of evidence.
Isn't this the case that no ballistics
was done on the bullets?
Say that again, Carrie.
Wasn't this the case that no ballistics was done on the bullets?
Absolutely. I requested the ballistics information, the ballistics report, because, first of all, they're stating that only two shots were fired. They stand by that.
There are three
however,
in the pictures.
And they need to stand by that, understand, because, first of all, when he left out of his home and he decided to pursue and confront Mr. Williams, according to self-defense, their self-defense law itself, and also according to the Castle Doctrine, when he decided that he wanted to come out of the safety of his home and confront and or pursue Mr. Howard, he took himself out of the protection of the Castle Doctrine and self-defense laws because he could have easily called the police. However, what happens, and this is where the officials come in, because what they're trying to do is say that because he shot him when he was raising the garage door and his arm was extended and he thought he had a gun or a flashlight or something, he perceived that was his point of the perception of fear that justified his use, or that he's using to justify the use of deadly force. So they have to state that only two shots were fired, because in that case, one of the shots would have hit Mark Howard and the other shot would have hit the neighbor's house. Where the third bullet and the third shot becomes important is because I contend that he was not shot in front of the garage, and that Mr. Williams, in fact, pursued Mr. Howard up the driveway and into the street in order to secure the third shot. And so when I asked for the ballistics evidence, they reported back to me that they do not do ballistics. They do not have the resources to do ballistics. SLED would be responsible for that, and that's the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division would be responsible for that, and they would only send that forward if they charged the case.
Well, most attorneys, is that normal?
I mean, in a case of a shooting,
shouldn't ballistics determine whether or not there should be charges filed, not the opposite?
But yes, ma'am. It's a problem right now, from what you're saying. It's a problem with the initial investigation.
Absolutely.
And securing the premises of a crime.
Absolutely.
And if they have allowed there to be tainted, the evidence, and they didn't take ballistics, then the district attorney is going to have a problem in proving a case.
Really?
If they didn't take the necessary immediate steps to secure the crime scene, take the ballistic testing and evidence at that time, it is going to be contaminated, and that could be a reason that the prosecutor is hesitant to bring a charge against the person, because they don't have the sufficient evidence to win it.
I'm not saying that is correct.
That is fair, but that could be a reason, because when they bring a case, you want them to win it.
And that's his
argument.
That's his argument, actually. And so I think, and in this case, I'm very confident, because that was the, they argued that he would have to disprove self-defense in order to prosecute the case. That was his argument. However,
yeah.
The things that the police department should have done, any police department should have done to investigate this as a homicide, they did not do. They did not take any kind of blood sample evidence, blood spatter evidence from the point of the garage. The homeowner's wife stated that Mark Howard was first in her yard, and then he made himself across the street to the neighbor's yard. They did not take any blood evidence from the neighbor's yard. Nothing. And actually, if you look at the crime scene photos, you will see that they more investigated it as a tampering with the vehicle than they did a homicide. And so all of the crucial things that should have been done in a normal homicide investigation, they failed to do, and therefore failed to be able to provide the evidence and gave the prosecutor or the solicitor justification for not prosecuting the case.
It seems like it's a civil rights violation.
I'm there with you. I'm with you.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the all-new KLA.
It was a crime, wasn't it?
Okay. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the all-new KLHD's 98.9 The Talk, bringing you center stage for tonight's topic, does the misapplication of the Castle Doctrine or the Make My Day law justify murder? If you're on the phone lines and have a question or a comment, press 1. Or if you're listening in via the Internet, dial in at 347-850-8390, and again, press 1. A reminder, the chat room is open tonight, so if you have a question or a comment, you can post it up in the chat room, and I will try to get to it by the end of the hour. Tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by African American News and Commentary Blog, your single source for news, events, and commentary that is is of unique interest to African Americans. They're located on the web at www.africanamericannewsandcommentary.com. Tonight's segment of Center Stage is also being brought to you by Daily Deposits for the Soul, your daily guide to enriching your soul and improving your mind in just 15 minutes a day. They're located on the web at www.dailydepositsforthesoul.com. Listen, in all of these shootings, and I want to talk now a little bit about the Bobby Gaston shooting. That one occurred in Monk's Corner. That was a little different in the sense that the family of Bobby Gaston says that it wasn't the way the newspapers reported it, that it was more of a setup than it was an actual home invasion. And again, Dr. Zoe is involved in this particular shooting. So, Dr. Zoe, can you set up what happened in that particular case? Can you tell us a little bit about what happened to Bobby Gaston?
Yeah. Bobby Gaston, Bobby Gaston's case is a little more tricky than Mark Howard's case. Bobby Gaston was actually in the homeowner's home, and so that created an issue. However, where I got involved with the case is that the homeowner, first the coroner did not allow the mother to see the body because they initially told the Williams family, Bobby Gaston's mother and his uncle, that he was shot in his chest, and that he was in the process of committing a home invasion, and that he had on a black mask and he had a black gun, and he pointed the gun at the homeowner, and so the homeowner shot him in the chest. Now, based on the Castle Doctrine in South Carolina, if that were the case, it would have been a clear-cut case of justifiable homicide. However, I got involved because they did not let the family see Bobby Gaston's body for about 7 days. When everything was uncovered, what happened is that Mr. Barwick, who is the homeowner, actually shot Bobby in the back of the head as he was fleeing the residence. Not only that, the garage door was left half open by Mr. Barwick's son, who has yet to be charged, because what the story has unfolded and no one, you know, wants to embrace is that the son actually set up his own home. He encouraged them to go into the home. From my understanding, and this part is rumor and speculation, that he owed someone something, and so he basically invited them into his home, left the garage door open, took the dog out of the house, and told them where to go and get whatever it was that they were supposed to get. However, his father was home, and his father did not know about it. Bobby Gaston was unarmed. He did not have on a mask. He actually had visited the home before. The father did know and was familiar with Bobby Gaston, and he was on his way out. He said that he shot him on the stairs, and he actually shot him when he was on the back deck, getting ready to the back porch, getting ready to run out of the back deck. It was a one bullet straight to the back of the head at a distance of greater than 4 feet. The question is, you know, for us was not so much dealing with the homeowner, but then the fact that Monk's Corner Police Department actually fabricated the evidence, planted evidence, and then fabricated the story with to the media about how Bobby Gaston was shot. So.
Didn't they say things like he had a gun,
yes.
And then the crime scene photos produced no gun?
No gun whatsoever. Not only was there no gun on Bobby's possession or around his body, there was no gun anywhere in the house.
Now, Mr. McKesson, the fact that he was in the home, you know, you can say home invasion or not home invasion, depending upon who you ask. How do you see that one?
Well, it is a little trickier in that, you know, under the Castle Doctrine and the Make My Day law, you know, it's not required that the person using deadly force knows the true intent or method in which the invader gets in. So the homeowner potentially has a stronger argument of a defense, as I see it, in that if he says, depending on what the lighting is and all, if he says, the light was low, I didn't recognize the person, he was in my home, I was fearful, I think he has a greater shot at a defense. although you still get to the question of...
It's 8 o'clock in the morning.
Well, again, you know, depending on, you know, still, you know, there still could be a lighting issue in terms of, you know, I heard that this person was in a garage, so, you know, so there still may be, lighting still may be an issue. So, I mean, I would just say if I were defending that individual, I would certainly be saying that there's some doubts as to whether or not the homeowner exceeded his legal rights.
Really?
Right.
Attorney Evans, what do you think?
I would say the same thing. That would be cautious whether the homeowner exceeded his rights and whether the homeowner is stopped from using the self-defense or the Castle Doctrine to protect his property. Mm-hmm.
And,
so.
In South Carolina, again, you know, we don't have the because I don't live there, but South Carolina does not have the property defense. Again, it specifically says an imminent threat to your life or their intent to cause great bodily injury. And so the question that Mr. Williams, who is Bobby Gadsden's uncle, had is that how could he pose a threat when he's running out of your house and you shoot him in the back of the head? And again, in this case, Mr. Barwick pursued Bobby Gadsden out of the house, and as he was leaving the house, he decided that he was going to deal with it and shoot him in the back of the head. But my concern, even in that case as well, isn't so much with the homeowner, but then it goes to the officials. First, the homeowner lied, just as Mr. Williams lied. And, you know, everybody's lying. That's my problem. Everybody tells a lie. If you know that you're justified, then just simply tell the truth. So everybody lies. And then the police come in, and instead of doing an accurate investigation or an objective investigation, homicide investigation, what they do is they come back and they plant evidence, and then they fabricate the story in their official statements to the media, and they gain support from the public, you know, who can easily perceive that this is a young black man who crossed the railroad tracks and went into a white man's house in a pretty affluent neighborhood, and so you deserve what you got. And my thing is, okay, Mr. Barwick may have, you know, it's questionable with Mr. Barwick, but then when you talk about the color of law violations and the authority's responsibility to not only investigate objectively, but to make sure that they don't fabricate evidence and that they report things fairly, then that's where the question comes into play. Because regardless, we can't have officials fabricating evidence and failing to properly investigate these cases in order to protect these homeowners from prosecution. It either is what it is or it isn't. And if it isn't, they need to be prosecuted. And my statement is if you don't prosecute them, then you go down with the bus, too. That's just how I feel.
Well,
I see, in a lot of these cases, I'm sorry, go ahead, Mr. McKesson.
Well, I certainly agree that, you know, the law enforcement officials should be accountable and prosecuted for falsifying evidence, because certainly they should not be in a position of either coaching homeowners how to lie or just doing it on their own. So, although the homeowner might be justified potentially, law enforcement certainly is well outside of their authority. They shouldn't be doing any of that, and they should be criminally liable in addition to civilly.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about this recent case that we covered Wednesday night, y'all. But it's so fascinating, and that's the Ursuline case. And Mr. McKesson kind of explained a little bit about it. But, Mr. McKesson, can you set it up again, exactly how that shooting took place in the Reliable Discount Pharmacy in Oklahoma City?
Okay, and for those who may be Ursuline supporters online, I would just let everyone know that what I'm reporting is what was introduced as evidence at trial and what appears to be what the jury relied upon. But basically, we have Jerome Ursuline, who's a pharmacist, and he and two other employees are at work when two African-American youth come in. And one of them... there's a question about whether or not they had a gun or not, but one may have had a gun, but Mr. Ursuline pulls out a gun, shoots the first youth in the head, and that kid drops, and the second robber flees the scene, and Mr. Ursuline leaves the pharmacy apparently in pursuit. And it appears that Mr. Ursuline, while pursuing the second person, discharged some rounds, comes back into the pharmacy. And also there's a surveillance tape which is showing the initial shot to the first child or first teen. And we see Mr. Ursuline leave, and we see the pharmacy, and although the teen is out of the view of the camera at this point because he's on the floor, nonetheless, we don't see any movement. We see Mr. Ursuline walk back into the pharmacy, appears to step over the wounded teen, goes to another part of the counter, and then comes back with a second gun, and then stands over the teen and shoots him 5 times. The medical examiner, their testimony was that this teen was still alive after the first headshot, and that the death was caused by one of the 5 shots. Mr. Ursuline had told the police initially that both individuals came into the pharmacy with guns, that one of them, if not both of them, had shot at him, and Mr. Ursuline claimed that one of the bullets actually struck him on the watch, injuring his wrist.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Ursuline also gave several other statements, which later the police established were not true. And so ultimately the case went to trial, and the jury, which in this case was an all-white jury, the jury deliberated and found Mr. Ursuline guilty of first-degree murder and imposed the punishment of life with the possibility of parole.
Now, that's what happened, y'all. But the city...
And
go ahead, Bob.
I think in that situation, the owner became the aggressor,
mm-hmm.
and when he went back in, he actually just intentionally wanted to kill this person, although he had already seriously injured him.
Mm-hmm.
And that the first round of shots, if he hadn't shot again, he may have had, and he had a consistent story, then he may have gotten out on the castle doctrine. But it appears that it was a credibility issue as well with him, and the fact he went back in and unloaded his gun on this defenseless person.
Now, if you say that out loud in the streets of Oklahoma City, on the wrong corner, she's suddenly be mobbed, right, Mr. McKesson?
Well, it's that bad.
I mean, this debate has gotten so heated. I'm sure maybe you haven't heard about this particular case, but it is so heated down there in Oklahoma City right now about this particular case.
I don't believe you could just go justify yourself shooting a person that's already down when there was no danger that this
but
person.
But down there, they're saying that the would-be robber was a thug, and this man had a clean, squeaky record. Then, therefore, you know, if he shot him once in the head, he was probably going to die anyway. How many times did we hear that, Mr. McKesson, the other night, and Dr. Zoe? A bunch of times. He was going to die anyway.
Well, I've been involved in this debate for 2 weeks, and the first night, I mean, what just truly shocked me, even as a citizen of Oklahoma, is we had several callers who just flat out just said this kid's life wasn't worth anything, and he got exactly what he deserved.
But that's a general consensus, though. And I have to say this because Mark Howard is white, And, you know, when I first came on with Bobby Gadsden, I'm like, okay, it's definitely a racial issue, and I know, you know, this is a sociological understanding, and it's historic. So, you know, people want to talk about the race card as if it's something that, you know, we have in our pocket and we pull out. So I understand that lynching and laws that are designed to allow people to disregard black life have been in effect since enslavement. So we're not going to negate that. However, when I talk to Ms. Lewis about Mark Howard, I'm like, okay, well, what's the common denominator? And Mr. McKesson said it, and I think we have to be real, real careful. The common denominator is how society deems whose life is worth living or not. Because with Mr. Howard, as an example, you know, with Bobby, it's this big black boy who has on a black mask and black clothes and a black shotgun, and everybody is like, oh, yes, he should, yep, the homeowner should have shot him in the back of the head, and I'd shoot him in the back of the head, too. And then with Mark Howard, is that he's a homeless guy. He doesn't have any family, and nobody cares about him. And so he shouldn't have been on Mr. Williams' property. And, yes, he deserved to die. And he had a record. And, yes, he deserved to die. The bottom line with all of the cases is, number one, people got angry.
Mm-hmm.
The common denominator is everybody got pissed off. And everyone who responds, all of the people who respond on the Facebook pages and the news sites or whatever, talking about, yeah, if someone comes on my yard, I'd do the same thing, or if they come in my house. People are angry, and they're using the law not to protect themselves, but to basically play out their aggression and their anger for someone violating them. And then the law comes in and assesses whether or not the victim, Mr. Howard, Bobby Gadsden, the young man in Oklahoma, the two gentlemen in this lady's house in Colorado or wherever they are, the law comes in and the law says, okay, I can see where you could take this person's life. And instead of them following the law, then what they do is they support the home and the business owners for shooting them, which is why I'm really envious of the Oklahoma case, because in that case, the jury, the prosecutor, the police officers were able to look at it objectively and judge it objectively, but because people want the right to play out their anger now, they're challenging that.
And isn't this a situation, too, though, when the deceased in all these cases had criminal records, then automatically law enforcement is saying, you know what, bad guy down, good man still up, so everything's fine?
Yeah.
Well, I think that is an attitude.
Huh?
Yep.
I think that's exactly the attitude.
Yep, I agree.
I mean, because it's like, you know what, it's like, what is the problem? This person has a criminal record. This person doesn't. You know, who's on whose property? So the fact that the person with the criminal record is on the property of the person who doesn't have a criminal record, it's almost as though law enforcement automatically says that things worked out as they should have.
Well, they may not say it like that, but their actions. So they can do sloppy investigations. Now, don't connect ballistics, don't secure this crime scene, and let the evidence be contaminated. And then the prosecutor is going to say, we don't have a sufficient evidence to go before a grand jury or so.
That's exactly what they're doing. So a sloppy investigation can equal we don't have anything to prosecute on.
Right, exactly.
Prosecutors like to win. They like to win. They like to have enough evidence. They think they can win. They don't win all the time. But they definitely want their officers and the investigators and the coroners to perform their task as expeditiously and secure the evidence and secure the chain of custody.
So what can the
family
of
the defense lawyers are going to tear you up if you don't have those things done.
So what can the families of the deceased do to push authorities to do this? I mean, to reopen these investigations, or can they?
You're going to have to show that you're going to have to show some good reasons for it to be reopened. Good.
So you
got to
do some investigative work.
It's not assumptions and speculation. You're probably going to have a little more. You're going to have more to really force them to reopen.
But then if they reopen and they don't have the evidence collected, that's what you're going to see. We don't have enough to go forward with the case.
Well, the other thing that we as a society needs to get back to that we've gotten away from is we've got to pull our voices together. You know, a lot of these people who've gotten these laws passed, they're able to do it because they've united and they've been able to basically send a message to the politician that if you don't do what I want, you know, we voted you in, we can vote you out. And a lot of people, it may not fix their immediate case, but a lot of people need to get involved with the NAACP, get involved with the ACLU, get involved with, every organization possible that can help unite voices and put, pressure on some of these politicians to say that we need to have accountability and we need to be able to create some type of balance so that we don't just have people out shooting and, shooting first and never even asking questions later.
Well, the other thing is that people need to use their First Amendment right to assemble, free speech, and they need to go to their legislators and help push bills through, but they are not involved as much with the legislators and to ask them to create bills. So you need bills, and if people will make noises and like you said, if they will come together, if they would be out, they would be an outcry since this happened in this neighborhood, and follow up and a format to advocate change, then it would be different. Then the police department would be cautious on how they investigate cases because they have some watchdogs in the community that are in the courts and on the streets that are watching how they dispense justice and when they are arrested and how things are done. But people are silent. And
how much weight does the coroner's report hold in these investigations? If the coroner comes back and he does his autopsy and he comes back and he says it's a homicide, does that hold any weight in terms of pushing the police to investigate further, or does that mean basically nothing?
Well, keep in mind that if the investigations are done correctly, the police should have already done investigation before you ever get a report back from the coroner.
Right.
Now, the coroner's report, I would suspect, would actually have more impact on the prosecutor, because if the coroner's report, say, in the Ursuline case, if it had come back and said this kid was dead from the first shot, then I don't think that Ursuline would have ever been charged. The prosecutor's office would have said the homicide's justified, and even if you had Ursuline shooting this kid the five other times, at best, Ursuline might have been charged with a misdemeanor of mutilation of a corpse, but he probably wouldn't even get that. So the coroner's report would have impacted the prosecutor, but should not have impacted the police.
Very interesting.
I also want to say, too, that there are limitations because, in the case of Mark Howard, there was some question about whether or not the homicide was justifiable. However, the coroner, it's not the coroner's job to determine whether or not it's justifiable. So the coroner, for example, in the Bobby's case and Mark's case, both, can specify the trajectory of the bullet, how far the person was away from the victim, et cetera, and at the end of the day, if a person gets shot, the coroner can only say that he was shot the manner of death, and if it's a death that one person shot another, it's a homicide. But then it's up to the prosecutor's office and or the solicitor's office to take that information and either use it or not, to either pursue the case or not. And in the case of both Mark Howard and Bobby Gadsden, where, it was very clear that there was some question about the manner in which each of them were murdered, The prosecutor still did not take that evidence and consider it as far as moving the case forward. And so, again, the murderers still get to stand free.
Wow. We're going to go back to the phone lines, area code 417-880. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Hi, this is Peggy Lewis. I am Mark Howard's sister.
Hi, Peggy.
I've been listening. Hi. I've been listening to this, and, you know, like my brother John, who was on the line a little while ago, said, this man chased my brother out. They told the investigators at first told us there were two shots. We found out a couple weeks ago there were three shots. So now they're trying to change the story about the first shot they told us about. They've done nothing but lie. Within 24 hours or maybe a little more, they closed the case. They thought he was homeless and had no family, and they just closed it. They said it's their law. That is what they keep telling us down there. It's their law. Dayton Riddle said there is no way in South Carolina a jury would convict a homeowner. But, of course, they don't know what all happened.
But that's one person's opinion. And who said that?
Dayton Riddle, the solicitor in South Carolina, Lexington County, he told me that there is no way that 12 jurors from South Carolina would convict a homeowner. And the story has changed so many times, it's unreal. We've got plenty of evidence, like Dr. Zoe said, and they will not budge and reopen the case and investigate it like they should have to begin with.
And you all have the autopsy report. You have the incident report. You have the crime scene photos. You have the 911 call. Is there something else that you all have?
We have versus. We have
ballistics that they didn't do.
They
told us that they
report.
Don't do ballistics. Yeah, they
but you have everything. You have
ballistics.
Everything else but the ballistics report, and they're saying that there is no ballistics report. But you really
right.
don't know if that's the case or not. But they're saying they don't have it.
But this
right.
is
they're
this
saying
is
they don't have it.
This is the issue, and this is where you know South Carolina becomes complicit. In South Carolina, the Castle Doctrine is 1611, 440, and 450, and then they have an amendment 395. When they first talked to Peggy, and then in the original incident report, police investigative report, they cited that it was a justifiable homicide. Justifiable homicide is codified in South Carolina law under 1611, 450, that's based on the 440, and that basically delineates the imminent threat of peril to a life or great bodily injury. So what I did was I laid out, after I got all of the documents that we were able to get, I laid out everything, and I specifically illustrated how the evidence basically ruled out the Castle Doctrine based on their law. What they did then is they changed it and said, oh, no, we didn't say that it was the Castle Doctrine. And then I spoke, and this is when I spoke to the state's attorney and I sent it to the assistant DA, Heather Weiss. Then all of a sudden it filters down, and by the time I get to the solicitor, he says, oh, no, we didn't say that it was the Castle Doctrine. We said that it was self-defense law. And when I challenged him, understanding that I'm a sociology professor and not an attorney, but when I challenged him and I said, well, self-defense is not a law, he says to me, well, no, but, you know, the judges, I'm like, okay, well, it's common law, but basically you can use self-defense, because I read it, you can use self-defense as a defense. But it's not a law. It may be common law, but it's not a part of your legislative body. He's like, well, it's self-defense law. And when he couldn't say anything, he got frustrated with me and said, well, I'm not going to debate with you about it. You know, we've already reviewed it. We've done what, you know, we've looked at it, and it doesn't match. So I went back and I read, and I can't remember offhand what the case is, but they have a specific case that they've used to establish common law around self-defense. And the case that they use and the protocol that they use is basically the same as the Castle Doctrine near 1611, 440. So, you know, again, it's to a point where it doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter what evidence you show. It doesn't matter how well you break it down. In South Carolina, they are determined, based on Charlie Condon's mandate, that anybody – who kills someone on their property is going to be protected. And they've been issued a mandate that neither are the police supposed to arrest nor the prosecutors prosecute those cases. And so in South Carolina, people are getting away with murder.
Mm-hmm. And I'm trying
yes,
to,
they
I'm,
are.
I'm sorry,
I would like to know some, from the attorneys, though. I do got a question for the attorneys who are on there.
Mm-hmm.
What else would we need to get them to to open the case and actually investigate it?
Hmm.
Well, I'm not a civil rights attorney.
And a lawyer
attorney,
to do this.
Well, I'm not a civil rights attorney, but I would say really talk to a civil rights attorney because, to me, I think the only way that you're ever going to really get the government, the police, the prosecution to really start reevaluating these policies is to start digging into their pockets.
Ooh.
Unfortunately in this country, when things start costing the government money, then they start rethinking.
Mm.
Okay. Well, I just know that the legislatures, again, have given them immunity, qualified immunity for their actions. So they will hide behind qualified immunity unless you can show that they intentionally did something or maliciously. But otherwise, they're going to hide behind the qualified immunity if they are sued. Now, how do you get them to reopen? Like I said earlier, you really are going to have some substantial evidence or some facts that have been recently developed whereby it would cause them to reopen it for good cause.
But in a situation like this, Attorney Edmonds, supposedly there's only the shooter, the homeowner, as the other witness, because supposedly there are no other eyewitnesses to what
right.
happened that night. It's 3:00 in the morning. Besides what they have, that the police report and the crime scene photos and the autopsy reports and the incident reports that show that there's no consistency in anything that has been said so far. I mean, nothing adds up. Yeah, and I've looked at all this. Nothing adds up. So what do they do? I mean, every time they question something that doesn't add up, they change the answers. It's like, okay, I didn't say that, I said this, or you misunderstood me, or whatever. So what can they do?
Most of the time when they actually find out or get information, inside information,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be from somebody that's basically a whistleblower that knew that they did something that was illegal, or change reports or evidence, and the only way you're going to find that is got to be from somebody on the inside.
Mm.
And it's unfortunate on this case, you have the deceased and you have the living person.
Mm-hmm.
And you have some inconsistencies.
Because we're talking about, let's start here. They're saying that he stole something that night, right? But if he stole it from a truck that had obviously been recently washed, there was no fingerprints on the inside or the outside of the truck. I mean, that's just how crazy the story is. So really it appears, to us lay people, that he never really even knew. So, in essence, this man really didn't take anything from this homeowner, but yet he was killed. And so when you challenge the police department, and I talked to that police department several times about this particular case, they even changed the answers on me. I'm just going to be honest. They really did. I talked to the certain person, I won't call her name, several times, and every time I talked to her, it was just a little different. No, you misunderstood me. No, what I said. No, I don't think I said that. I think I said this. I even actually experienced some of that myself. And so I couldn't keep it straight. I was like, can you put it in writing? Because obviously I'm not understanding what you're saying. And she did go on record and put some answers to some of the questions on record. But before that, everything seemed to keep changing.
As it does across the board with each of the cases. And I think, it goes back to my original question because, at a point where you see a pattern across the board, you're talking about from Oklahoma through Texas and all the way to South Carolina, at a point where you see patterns establishing across the board, and then especially in South Carolina, I'm very convinced that in South Carolina that they are very much supported in this mandate to try your best not to charge homeowners. If you can protect them from prosecution and arrest, try your best not to charge them if they murder someone who may have been on their property or not. I'm very convinced. But then it goes back to my question about the national mandate, and then it goes back to the larger question about what does this really mean? You know, what is it really saying? And I, you know, people call me a conspiracy theorist sometimes, and you know, I'm going to take that on the chin because it is what it is. You know, but in studying history, this looks real reminiscent of the lynch laws of the past. And I think that we really, really have to be conscious of what the implications of that are going to be, specifically to the African-American community. And while I'm just as committed to Mark Howard's case as I am to Bobby Gadsden, what I do understand is that, you know, and what happens on these boards that I see, and I'm going to invoke it because it is what it is and we're talking about it, what happens on these boards, especially in South Carolina, is that you have these posters who have these Confederate flags and they're citing the right to bear arms, and, you know, the N-word is flying all over the place, and that, you know, people should he Bobby deserved to die, and now Mark Howard, you know, there's a little bit more empathy because of the situation. But what happens is that when these laws get established and they're either directly and or indirectly geared towards a certain population, then other people are going to get caught in the net. And when that works, it elevates to the next level and to the next level and to the next level. So at this point, I'm not quite sure that I can go through South Carolina, and I'm not really sure that I can go through the federal agencies, because I really do believe that this may be a national mandate or the direction that the national government, the federal government, is moving to.
But you know, one thing I've noticed in all these situations, any time that there's a shooting, shouldn't it be automatic that there be a certain protocol? That it shouldn't just be the homeowner said or the business owner said, so therefore it was a perceived threat, so it's justified. Should not there be, okay, an investigate, you know, a police report that's detailing the who, what, when, where, and how, and then a thorough investigation, including ballistics, or if it's a knife situation, the bloody knife be taken into evidence and everything be proven, not just the word of the homeowner or business owner.
Anyway. Well, I agree. There should be a protocol.
Well, there actually is.
They're not following it then.
Most of the doctrines state that even in the case of justifiable homicide, because in order to find something justifiable, you first have to do a homicide investigation. So most of the laws state that police are supposed to conduct a normal homicide investigation. My issue is that, you know, at first my issue was, well, you know, the police don't need to make that determination. They need to pass it forward and have the prosecutors or the solicitors to thoroughly evaluate the information. But in South Carolina, it really doesn't matter.
And for anybody else who may be experiencing a similar situation, you have the right under the Freedom of Information Act to request any information. Is it from a government agency? Is it just from government agencies or who? And I forget. And I think it is just like the police departments or the courts or whatever. As long as the investigation has been closed, you have the right to request this information. They will not release it if it's an active investigation, but as long as these investigations have been closed, like in the case of Mark Howard, that's how the family was able to get the police report and the crime scene photos and the autopsy reports, because the investigation has been closed. Is that correct, y'all?
Well, actually, in Oklahoma, you can get the police report whether the investigation's open or closed, but the problem is, short of a court order, they block out all the names of every individual, so the report is useless because you don't know what piece of information connects to what individual.
I'm sorry, say what?
In Oklahoma, our Open Records Act or Freedom of Information Act, it allows anyone to get copies of police report irrespective of whether or not the investigation is ongoing or not.
Oh, wow.
But the problem is that the police department, when they release the report, every person's name is blocked out.
Okay.
So that you cannot make heads or tails
out of what allegations are being reported about what individual.
See, you know, the whole thing with these agencies, when you talk to them, first of all, in all the police departments that I had to get this information from, a lot of them, when you call and ask questions, they give you the brush off as though whatever they say is written in stone. So how dare you question that things were any way other than what they said they were?
Absolutely.
I mean, Dr. Zoe and Peggy, I'm sure y'all can speak to that. Didn't they kind of give you that air, like, you, how dare you question what I said or what the police report said or what anything, when it, anything that was said by the police department, how dare you question it, is my point. Didn't you feel that, Dr. Zoe?
Well, I mean, you know, Peggy's brother's case happened in February. And until May, I believe we got into it in May, until May, she was unable to receive anything.
Mm.
She requested it. She sent letters requesting it, everything from she got the incident report, but she did not get the crime scene photos. She didn't even, and I don't know if she's still on the line, but she can speak to this. She couldn't even get her brother's belongings. But yet she was the one who buried him and who dealt with the coroner and who got his body. So, you know, she didn't get anything. And with me, I've learned that, you know, I'm not going to just come to you. I'm going to come to you and I'm going to cite what your responsibilities are under the law, so that if you fight it, then you just make yourself, you know, dig a hole for yourself. So we were able to get some things, but, you know, there's always resistance.
Hey, yeah, I'm sorry, I closed your line accidentally. Did you all get all kind of, like, flack from the police department when you all were asking questions initially?
Oh, yes, they didn't. They just like you said, they was like, why are you questioning this? This is what happened. This is how it happened. And we know our brother. We didn't believe what they said. And then as we kept going on and finding out more and more, there's just so many inconsistencies with the homeowner's story. And when we did finally get the evidence, the 911 tape, none of it makes sense. My brother was shot in the side. It went through both of his lungs and his heart. And they're trying to say that he was shot up by their garage and made it 166 feet. Now, and across the street in the neighbor's yard. There's no way. And the 911 call, the lady says, the wife says that he's in their front yard, and she still sees movement. Somehow he got up on his bike and rode across the street. It was, I think it was 50 feet, 54 feet across the street into the neighbor's yard. Now, this, it had been the third shot, because the first one went to the house next door. The second one went to the house across the street, and they chased him down.
Now,
and they just told so much. It's ridiculous how it was really not investigated. It was, homeowner said this, the wife was not questioned, there was nothing.
Now that is true. The wife called the 911 call in, but she was not, you know, there's no statement, it appears, that they took from the wife. You know,
no,
so
she
seems
to know an awful lot.
Yes, on the 911 tape, she does say quite a lot. And so it just seems like in all these situations, the police department went in. I mean, in some of these incident reports, really, you all should read them. They read like, I mean, basically somebody went in and was just casually mentioning that, you know, a situation occurred, not necessarily that somebody was killed, but it just kind of like, you know, went in and the body this. Not what happened that, you know, What was the incident that occurred that produced a body? You know, was somebody, you know, before this happened, somebody walked in here or somebody was on this property and they were still living. But these police reports almost just kind of pick up like we walked in and the body was there and we did this. And I'm thinking, well, what happened? Wasn't that the case in Bobby Gaston's, was it Bobby Gaston's police report that I remember? It really didn't even read what happened. Dr. Zoe, you remember, don't you?
Say that again, Carrie.
On Bobby Gaston's police report, didn't it kind of just pick up like they walked in and the body was there and that's what happened after that? They really didn't say what the homeowner said happened in that particular case?
No, they didn't.
And I couldn't believe they didn't say, the homeowner said at such and such time he observed and then this happened and then that happened. It really just kind of picked up that the police walked in and a body was in the floor.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I would think that it would be standard procedure that you would say, at such and such time, the homeowner said this occurred. And then whatever occurred caused him to kill. But that's not the case.
No, well, they couldn't do that with Bobby's case because everything that the homeowner said occurred wasn't supported by the evidence. And so I think that that was one of the reasons why they kept that out of the incident report.
Well, they do that. They keep it out of the media. The media lies, or they're lying to the media. I don't know which. Probably those. But and they don't do their job. So the media, and you go on the even the newspaper, the things they were saying about my brother in the book, they have no clue what really happened. And to this day, unless they're hearing these shows, they don't know. Because when you call the news stations down there, and say, hey, I got evidence that this did not happen the way the homeowner said, they won't touch it. They will not put it in the paper.
I think the police department has a responsibility in the case of a deadly shooting that the incident reports say what happened. You can't say you walked in and a body was there, and so the report picks up what happened after you walked in and the body was laying in the floor. No, that body, something happened to cause the body to get there.
Right. Right.
And so I think, you know, it's us as the community that's not demanding answers.
Right.
Because, you know, that's one of the things that I first noticed in the Bobby Gaston shooting, that there was no who, what, when, where, and how.
Right.
Which I thought in law enforcement always was supposed to be covered in a report. You know, who, what, when, where, how, and how, you know, who, what, when, where, and how should always be a situation or should be documented on a police report. We're going to go back to 304. I think that's Mr. Howard's brother again. Good evening. 304. I'm having trouble opening his line. Good evening, 304 again. Hello? We're having trouble opening.
If that Bobby's shooting, if there's a 13-minute delay before they called 911, in the case of my brother's.
Oh, no, you don't mean Bobby, you mean Mark Howard's case.
Well, I mean Mark, but Bobby, too.
Oh, Bobby.
They waited 13 minutes to get their story straight before they called 911.
I just
wondered if they'd done the same thing in Bobby's case, waited so long before they called 911.
No, they didn't. They didn't. They went... He went across to the neighbor's house and called. I'm not quite sure what the time frame was on that one, but it looks like he ran out of the house and he went to the neighbor's house. But you know what? That might be. That's a good question, Carrie. I don't know if we had the 911 time on there because there were the parts that were released didn't have the time on it like they did in the case of Mark Howard. So I'm not sure what the time frame was.
And I'm not sure either. You know, I mean, it almost seems like he's saying that it was immediately he ran out of the house and ran next door, but I don't think they clocked it like they did in the other situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what he said. But, you know, just like the Mark Howard case, too, they acted as if the incident was in progress when they made the phone call. So, yeah, and there were some sketchy things on the Bobby Gadsden 911 tape as well. But
they're all kind of sketchy.
Can someone define the whole term in the Castle Doctrine, and I guess in the Make My Day Law, when it says you have the right to retreat or you don't have the right to retreat? How does that go?
Well, a lot of it's cover up.
Some states have what they call a duty to retreat, and that means that if someone comes in your house and you're able to get out or you're able to take some other recourse rather than to use deadly force, then you first have a responsibility to do that. And then other states have a stand your ground, and that means that you don't have to leave and you don't have to take any other kind of action, that if someone is posing a threat to your life, or your safety, then you can use deadly force without first having a duty to retreat or use any other options.
But shouldn't in all cases you have a duty to retreat if the truth be known? I mean, because if you are really saying that I'll take a man's life because he stole a radio or he stole a TV, it really just doesn't make sense. If I had an opportunity to run from the house and keep from shooting and killing someone because they were stealing a TV, I think that should be the case. And so I don't understand why some states are saying you should, and then other states are saying you don't have to.
It makes it easier. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think that goes back to what we said earlier in the discussion, that we're in a society where life has lost its value. And I agree that if someone is to use deadly force, that they should use it as a last resort. But unfortunately, we're in a society where it appears that if you do anything to offend me and you have to be in my business or house, well, the law is going to just give me the right just to shoot first and never ask any questions about it.
And see, the thing is, you know, people will take this discussion and say, okay, they're pro the criminal. But it's really not the case. It's just pro-right versus pro-wrong. I mean, it just doesn't seem like in an economy that's down like it is, that people are not going to expect that there's going to be some petty thievery going on. And so for every petty thief that steals something, I don't think he has a right to lose his life. Stealing is never right. I mean, because, you know, you're messing with somebody else's property. But at the same time, I don't know that we should look at it like if he steals my radio, then I have a right to kill him. Or if he steals, you know, my TV, I have a right to kill him. I don't think that makes sense to me. I just don't. I mean, because in a situation like Mark Howard, it really just seems like he assumed the man was breaking in his truck, and I don't think the man actually had an opportunity to go in his truck. So, therefore, he killed him for what seemed like trespassing to me. I mean, because if he never entered his truck and he never broke into his truck, then all he did was trespass on his property. And do we now want to kill people for trespassing on our property, even if it is 3 o'clock in the morning?
Yep.
I mean, I don't know.
Well,
that's just crazy.
I want to invoke into the conversation what the senator stated on Wednesday. Because I think what he stated on Wednesday, and again, coming from a senator, I think that is really important. When he said that police are not there to protect people. So he carries his gun in his pocket to protect himself because he cannot carry a police officer in his pocket to protect him. And I think what's happening in the movement right now is that, you know, and you have to look at it systematically. If a police officer did what Mr. Ursuline did, or if a police officer did what Mr. Williams or Mr. Barwick did, they would be under investigation and they would probably face criminal charges, period, in either case. So in order to avoid that, then, it seems like the state is giving ordinary citizens the right to police in the manner that police can't, and that the state is then going to protect the citizens. And so I don't know if you all are understanding what I'm saying, but that way, if a citizen does it and the state is the authority figure over the citizen and the state is going to protect the citizen, then what the police would want to do and can't do, perhaps, or when they can't be there, an ordinary citizen does it and there's no repercussion to that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, because the state senator said something so ridiculous. He said, you know, in a situation where someone's robbing a business, he said that it didn't matter if they shot the would-be robber 2 times or 50 times. As long as they perceived that he was still a threat, they should keep firing. That's
right,
crazy.
He said that.
Did he say that?
Yeah.
That is what he said.
Sure did.
And you would think, like, okay, who needs to shoot anybody 50 times for the threat to be removed?
But it's telling that that's coming from a United States senator. I'm still kind of shocked that that's actually a senator. But you know, and for him to be confident enough in his position to come on, you know, on air and to publicly make that statement. And see, I know that people don't do things when they feel that they'll be ostracized from the group, and that's group thinking, group conformity. And so when he said that, and as he asserted himself throughout his whole conversation, you know, we got to start to think, if that's how he feels when they're in the boardroom together and they're having discussions, I'm pretty sure he's not the only one with those sentiments.
Oh, I agree.
Right,
and you know
right.
what? And remember the NAACP president down at the state conference down at the NAACP? Remember he said in Oklahoma, that's acceptable. And we kept saying, no, that couldn't be acceptable. And he goes, yeah, you can talk like that in Oklahoma. And Mr. McKesson, maybe you can speak to the environment down there in Oklahoma. Is that really the case?
Unfortunately, that really is the case, in that people very openly will always say, or have for years said, that if some guy walked in there, or actually what they commonly say is, if someone just walked in their yard, the sentiment is shoot them, drag the body in, and tell the police that they broke in your house and you'd be protected.
See, well, you know what? That's just scary to me. I mean, because it seems like, you know, they're saying it like it's a joke, but it's really, you know, what they stand by. I mean, because the way the senator talked, and he went on for 2 hours, y'all, the way he talked, it was as though he knew that his voters backed him. And the way he was talking, it was almost as though he was campaigning on this show.
Well, and to add to that, you know, and it goes back to, you know, he was able to get elected in, and one thing we talked about, he got elected in on the promise that he was going to see Jerome Ursuline freed. And he, on the air, said that he would spend his last career breath fighting for Mr. Ursuline. And what he goes back to is unfortunately, the people in his district, those who may have opposing views, have not been vocal. So yes, he can express those opinions without fear of any legal repercussion, because those who really, you know, vote for him agree with his mindset.
But see, you know, and I talked to my brother about this, who's listening tonight, and he made a very good point. When you put laws in place intending to get a certain group, you're always going to get some of your own. You know, I mean, for the most part, I think most of us realize who these laws were written for.
Right.
Well, Carrie, I think that if the people do not go back to some, like I said, they need to take peaceful action, speak out, go to the courthouses, make sure they see how they're administering there, file complaints with the city attorney, file complaints with the police department, internal affairs, when things are not going right or you think there's a problem. Particularly in this case, file a complaint against the officer himself and the department in the way they managed it. The officer, for his work, if he was responsible for investigating, if they get these types of complaints and follow through and appear at city council meetings and other meetings, go to the legislature, that's going to make a difference. They're going to say the people are not silent. We better be careful. Call the chief of police and say, come to the community. We want a community meeting on this shooting. We want answers. Let them develop a community liaison. So it's got to be some things like that in addition to the legal reaction.
Because you know what? The one thing I've noticed in this whole debate down in Oklahoma, and Mr. McKesson can probably speak more to it, the black community has almost been silent on this. Am I right,
well,
Mr. McKesson?
That's why they're silent.
Yeah. Well,
yeah,
they've been silent. Well, no, they've been silent from the standpoint of, I would say that the sentiment of the black community while the case was pending was that we were going to wait and see what the outcome was going to be. And I can't speak for the black community as a whole, but I was surprised by the verdict because I thought that with Oklahoma City mentality that they were just going to say this young man got what he deserved. Once the verdict came out, what, you know, totally surprised me is that the people who are outraged with the verdict now have raised complaints and issues that defendants and especially black defendants have raised for years. They are now complaining about the police questioning Mr. Ersland without Mirandizing him. They're questioning the medical examiner. They're questioning the entire system, and so it's one that right now I don't think the black community has to be vocal as far as saying the system has its flaws, because we've been saying that for years. It's just now it's interesting that you now have a white community saying that because they didn't get the verdict that they wanted, we got all these flaws. But
well,
in
what
Oklahoma,
I'm saying, the community down there is silent. The supporters of Mr. Ersland, which seems to be mostly white, have taken to, you know, petition drives. I mean, they got, I guess, 12 Facebook pages. I mean, they put a website. They're threatening the governor. They're calling on all of their politicians. I mean, they're doing everything humanly possible. You know, they're calling for a pardon for this man before he's even sentenced. You know, they're doing everything humanly possible to get this man freed. But I don't hear anything from the black. So I guess that's what I'm speaking of. You know, compared to what I see the other side doing, I don't hear any response from the black community, really.
Well,
you see what I'm saying, Mr. McKesson?
Well, and I would say this would probably be one that if we had Mr. Douglas, our local NAACP president, I think he would probably have a different response, because I got the impression when he was on the air and also certainly with some of the off-the-air discussion, I got the impression that the NAACP has been involved to some degree, not as publicly as Ersland supporters, but, you know, I've got the impression that NAACP has been heard and has been involved.
And that's true, and I'm sorry, and not to take anything from Anthony Douglas down there, because he has done an awesome job. No, what I was speaking of was, he has, but what is everybody else doing? As he told Dr. Zoe and I and you, they need help. I mean, the NAACP cannot fight everything, I mean, by themselves. We got to get up as a community and do something ourselves, too, to help the NAACP in some of these fights. But I agree. Mr. Douglas said, I think he was partly instrumental in making sure that Ersland was charged, was he not?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, so I agree. He's been very vocal, I think, behind the scenes. But, you know, I don't know. I guess I've just seen so much of what the supporters have done, but I just hadn't seen nearly that same amount of effort on the other side. And it may be because they got the verdict they want. Maybe they don't see a need to say anything now because, you know, things are appearing to go their way. But many people were questioning whether or not this is even going to stand, that they were saying that Ersland is going to get out, that he's not going to end up staying in jail. Do you believe that?
Well, I think certainly there's certainly possibilities. You know, Mr. Ersland still has the appeal process, and it's certainly possible that he could get a new trial. But then also the people who are petitioning the governor, that still has to work through its process with the Pardon and Parole Board. But there's certainly a possibility that the governor could, for whatever reason she may articulate, she very well could issue a pardon also. So there's a lot of things, a lot of factors that have to be played out before we know the outcome.
Wow. That's going to be a very interesting
case. To go back to your point, though, from an activism perspective, because I think that you raised a really, really strong point. You know, we depend on the NAACP and we depend on organizations to deal with issues that are going on in the African-American community. The problem with these organizations is that they're divided by state, And I don't think that they understand that this issue here, because we're not, you know, we're not just dealing with some person on TV using the N-word or whatever. We're dealing with laws that are being constructed to allow people to take human lives. And so the question becomes, at the end of the day, you know, whose lives are going to be taken? And for the African-American community, because when you look at these cases, largely you're talking about situations where the shooter is Caucasian and the victim is African-American. And I think we have to get to a point where we have to find ways to elevate the consciousness of the masses and to unify the masses and educate the masses about what's going on. Because even though in the Ursuline case, Ursuline was convicted, I think that's great. But there are so many more cases other than that of Ursuline where people are not being convicted. And I think, you know, even not even as a race perspective, but as an issue, because as the Lewises can attest to, it's their brother too, that we need to get together and we need to challenge the Castle Doctrine, period. Because regardless what anybody says, I just don't think that ordinary citizens are prepared, based on all of the things that I've read in the comments or what have you, I do not think that ordinary citizens are prepared to be given the right to determine whose life is going to be taken or not. Because people come from their experiences, they come with their perceptions, and at the end of the day, I don't think that when people are in those situations, they're going to be able to critically think, you know, what's right and wrong. So I think that we need to come together and just challenge the Castle Doctrine, period.
Great. Okay, y'all, final comments. We're down to our last 6 minutes of the show. Attorney Bobby Edmonds, final comments on the Castle Doctrine or the Make My Day Law? Or
I think people need to be more cognizant, and they need to speak out and contact their legislators to make some changes in the law, and they need to be more vigilant in making sure that investigations are conducted properly and immediately after offenses, so that the evidence can be preserved and justice can be done. There's a lot of work left to be done.
Agree. Attorney McKesson, final comments on the Castle Doctrine or the Make My Day Law?
Well, not to repeat Attorney Edmonds, because I wholeheartedly agree with everything she said on that, but to expand on that, people need to be aware of the legislation and ask questions about exactly how that legislation is going to play out, and think in terms of what doors are being opened. And as a society, we need to be asking, you know, bottom line, what value do we place on life? And if life is supposed to be something that is precious, then we should use caution before we just let someone take it without holding them responsible.
Thanks, great. Dr. Zoe, final comment.
I mean, I have to agree with everything that the panelists have said, but I think that something was said earlier. We need to do research and understand how this law is affecting our community, and I think that we need to really revisit basically how it has diminished the quality of human life.
Wow. Listen, y'all, thank you. I have really enjoyed this debate, and I hope the audience did as well. I'd like to say thank you to Attorney Bobby Edmonds, Dr. Zoe Spencer, and Attorney Anthony McKesson. Also, a reminder, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage or the host. Also, a reminder, y'all, we're going to switch it up. I've been talking about the Castle Doctrine for about 3 or 4 weeks now. We're going to go a totally different direction next week, June 24, 2011, from 8 to 10 p.m. Central Time. Our topic is, get ready, y'all, Black female and bisexual living in the South. You heard me right. So y'all got to come back here next Friday night. It is going down. Two of the most interesting females I've talked to in a long time will be on the panel tomorrow, next Friday night. Black female and bisexual living in the South will be our topic. I want to again thank everyone for tuning in tonight, and again to my guests. Thank you so much for this spirited debate. I'll talk to you all next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.